From Bureaus Worldwide, this is
FSN, Simon. FSN. It's not that difficult. How you doing, by the way? It's Tuesday, December 1st. Winter is here. Certainly felt like it this morning. It is the old BBG with you, Richie Allen, on the radio until 7 o'clock. Thanks for joining me.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, this hour I'll be joined by Emma. Emma is not her real name. She's a friend of the program who, in reality, she works for a very, very renowned international company. She's got a senior role. I know who Emma is. Her colleagues and friends have been asking her about the prospect of having to take a vaccine against their will. She's been looking into it, and Emma will be on the programme with me this hour. And in the second hour, Posy Parker returns to the programme, a very prominent gender-critical feminist. You know all about Posy. You will probably know by now that the High Court judge, well, three High Court judges in this country have ruled that children under 16 need to be able to understand puberty blocking drugs and what those drugs might do to them. Is they need to be more informed before undergoing such treatment if they have gender dysphoria. This is a big story. We'll get into that in the second hour. And as usual, you can join in through Twitter. You know that. Now, I needn't tell you that because you know it. Alrighty. Welcome. Let's get on with it. 24 days then till Christmas. Yeah. You will be aware, you might have heard, Simon, on the news, that the UK Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has been urging MPs to back the three-tier system for COVID as the second lockdown comes to an end on Wednesday. They've been debating this in Westminster today. In reality, there isn't a snowball's chance in hell that it won't pass. It'll pass. The Labour Party and the SNPs are abstaining. Maybe about 100 Tory rebels, but we'll be back into the three-tier system, with most people in the country being in tiers two and three. It's basically lockdown by another name. Would you like to hear some of what Boris Johnson said today? You wouldn't? Ah, well. Here he is winding up his statement. I won't subject you to an awful lot of it. He's winding up here before he commends his statement to the House, and he says a couple of interesting things, including right at the very beginning. Listen carefully.
And while our scientists have been zeroing in on the weaknesses of COVID, telescoping 10 years of work into 10 months.
Got to hear that again. This is what I keep telling people who ask me, what do you know about vaccines, Baldy? You big ignorant Baldy bastard. Who are you to talk? And I always say, I'm nobody to talk, but I have a brain on me, in me, and I have brains around me. Listen again.
And while our scientists have been zeroing in on the weaknesses of COVID, telescoping 10 years of work into 10 months.
Yeah, telescoping 10 years into 10 months of a brand new memory or RNA vaccine, the likes of which has never been seen before, which is basically gene therapy by another name. Nobody has a Scooby-Doo what it will do to the body in the long term. Hence, I wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. Okay, what else did he say?
And now their endeavours are about to deliver the means, as I say, to rout the virus. Then that is clear. The government is backing not one potential vaccine, but seven. We've ordered 100 million doses of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine that's now seeking regulatory approval. We've ordered 7 million doses of the Moderna vaccine, which has almost 95% effectiveness in trials. And, Mr. Speaker, we've ordered 40 million doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, which, if approved by the regulator, could start being administered before Christmas. In total, Mr. Speaker, our vaccines task force has secured more than 350 million doses, more than enough for everyone in the UK, the Crown Dependencies and our overseas territories. All we need to do now, Mr. Speaker, is to hold our nerve until these vaccines are indeed in our grasp and indeed being injected into our arms.
Hold our nerve until the vaccines are in our grasp and being injected into our arms. Hold your nerve. So put up with house arrest. Put up with your business and your livelihood being pissed down the toilet because the vaccines are only around the corner, Boris Johnson. That's the gist of it. I won't subject you to any more of it today. Now, comments by the vaccine minister. We do have one now. Nadeem Zahawi is the vaccine minister charged with being responsible for overseeing the rollout of the vaccine. He said service providers might insist that customers have a vaccine passport. And he said that yesterday, and it dominated news media today. BBC Radio 5 presenter Rachel Burden is increasingly weighing in on the side of those who want the vaccine ASAP. Speaking to her co-host this morning and reading texts from listeners on COVID passports, she said something quite extraordinary. You will hear Nikki Campbell first, then you'll hear Rachel Burden.
What I will say is the texts are coming in already on one particular issue. For Sean referred it earlier on as the jabs and the jabs not. This idea that was mooted yesterday by the vaccine minister, Nadeem Zahawi, it's not going to be, as you said, mandatory. It's not going to be the law, but he said it might be up to individual venues in the, you know, restaurants, bars and cinemas may turn customers away if they have not had the COVID jab. Now, those worried about civil liberties and medical confidentiality right now will be going, what? But then it might be a thing to get the economy going. It might be the responsible thing to do. One of the ways that we get the wheels turning again. Texts already, Rachel.
Oh, so many of those. Let me read you a couple here. Martin from Ipswich, read the idea of mandating vaccines before going to festivals, etc. It depends on the rollout of the vaccine. If the government's restricting it to certain groups, there is no way other groups will be able to get it. So, for example, your festival-going punter may not be able to actually physically get their hands on one in time for the festival. Really? Is this viable? Another one here. Forcing vaccines by law or stealth is a very serious matter for a supposedly liberal country. It doesn't help those with concerns if forced to take it. If they are safe, why the compulsion worrying? But then no one's forcing you to go to a concert hall. No one's forcing you to go and watch sport or go to a festival, right? So these are personal choices.
Mm. Getting texts from listeners saying it's very wrong to be denying people who want to go to a festival or who want to go to a concert, denying them access because they aren't vaccinated. It's not a good thing. And the BBC presenter's response was,
but then no one's forcing you to go to a concert hall. No one's forcing you to go and watch sport or go to a festival, right? So these are personal choices.
Mm. She's all in, Rachel Burden. What did the squirrely little Michael Gove have to say about it, government minister? Here he was this morning on BBC Breakfast Television with Dan Walker, Michael Gove.
Will there be a sort of COVID passport for those who had the vaccine?
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. I mean, that's not the plan. What we want to do is to make sure that we can get vaccines effectively rolled out. There are three vaccines, as we know, that are going through tests at the moment in order to make sure that they're safe and that they can provide people with the shot in the arm required in order to liberate them from some of the fears that the virus inevitably generates about our health and our welfare. Of course, individual businesses have the capacity to make decisions about who they'll admit and why, but the most important thing that we should be doing at this stage is concentrating on making sure that the vaccine is rolled out, and my colleague Nadeem Zahawi is a brilliant minister. That's the reason that he's been put in charge of the programme of making sure that as many people are vaccinated as possible. It's up to any individual pub owner or licensee to decide who they'll admit and on what basis. They're private businesses. But
This is what they're going to do. He said it isn't the plan. It's not the plan at the moment, said Michael Gove, but it is the plan. And they will use the private sector to achieve this. They do want to coerce you and me and everybody else into having the vaccine. Coercion by way of denying you access to places that you really need to go. And they'll use the private sector to roll this out. And there's no doubt about that. It's not conjecture. This is a fact.
But actually, I'm not sure that's what people are concerned about this morning. I think what people are concerned about this morning is making sure that we're managing the infection effectively.
Yeah, nonsense. Everybody was concerned about that this morning. Everybody on UK talk radio right across the stations was talking about whether or not they would have to have a vaccine in order to go and socialise or do other things. Anyway, what about the private sector then? Hospitality, for example. Emma runs the Stables restaurant in Exeter. Sounds a bit flash for me. Would she be happy asking people for a vaccine certificate before being seated? Here she is on BBC Radio 5 Live with Nikki Campbell.
Well, I think it's something that we have to seriously consider. Being in the hospitality trade, things have been pretty tough so far. If it enables us to be able to get our pubs back open safely, which is everybody's priority, you know, we have a big responsibility for our team and the customers that come through our door and to keep them safe at the same time. You know, we have a lot of people isolating that haven't been out for months and months and months. And we want them to feel safe to come out and be able to come into the pubs. So it's something, yeah, I would consider it.
Of course, those people who are back at the vaccine queue will be railing at this very moment. But so what would a heaving, pumping, classic, traditional night at the Stables pub and restaurant look like? I arrive at your door and you greet me, or not, as the case may be. How would it work?
Well, it would work that you'd be greeted by one of our very smiley members of staff, very politely asked to show any sort of ID that you've received the vaccination. And then that would enable us then to show your table, and that's where you'll be seated. But, you know, we have a lot of older customers that come to us, so it would be a massive consideration for us to, for them to feel safe within our environment.
Mm. Yeah. And there were a number of other publicans and restaurateurs appearing on TV and radio today saying, yeah, good idea. Why not? We'll ask people at the door, have you had the vaccine? Have you got any proof? And if you have, well, you can come in. Lovely. Martin McKee is a professor of European public health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. We're staying with BBC Radio 5 Live today on this particular monologue. Lot going on. Nikki Campbell asked him, why not protect the vulnerable and let everybody who isn't vulnerable get on with their lives? What did he say?
And there's really no evidence for this at all. I just don't understand why it keeps having traction.
Well, people say, well, you know, protect the vulnerable and the rest of us can get on with it. I'm sure you've heard that argument as well.
We see it every day. Yeah, and it's nonsense. So, I mean, why it's nonsense is, so what are we going to do? Are we going to take vulnerable elderly people, put them in a cocoon, lock the door and leave them to fend for themselves?
You know? It's exactly what you did back at the outset of all of this. And it's what killed so many of them. Because you don't protect a senior citizen who's got dementia, maybe, and who's got a very compromised immune system. You don't protect them by locking them into a hermetically sealed care home with terribly bad ventilation. And then you admit to that care home people that you've left out of hospitals, old people you've left out of hospitals, you've discharged without checking them. That's not looking after people. That's not what the great Barrington Declaration doctors advocated. They didn't advocate doing what you and your mates did back in the spring. They said, look after people in care homes by giving them vitamin C and vitamin D, regular trips outside, fresh air, a change in diet, a more appropriate diet at that time of year, all these things. But Campbell could say to him, you know, but he doesn't. And it is his duty to say to him, the great Barrington doctors, many of them are more qualified than you to talk about this. So who are you to say it's nonsense? But of course, Nikki Campbell won't do that.
So, you know, somebody's got to come in and help them. And those younger people are going to be transmitting disease to and from the population if we're not careful. This is what happens.
Transmitting disease. Younger people are going to be transmitting disease. You see, I know that guys like this guy here, this guy McKee, from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, I know that he is a traitor to humanity. I know he is. I know in my heart of hearts that this guy McKee knows that he is talking monumental bollocks, which makes him worse than pond scum. Pond scum. He knows this is bullshit. That's the worst of it for me. I wouldn't mind if Martin McKee was just wrong. There isn't anything wrong with just being wrong and not understanding what's happening. He knows, and yet he shills on BBC Radio 5 Live and God knows where else, peddling his bullshit about young people spreading disease. Huh? Nobody representing the great Barrington doctors suggested locking old people or vulnerable people into their homes and just leaving them there to fend for themselves. That's nonsense. But Nicky Campbell's not going to challenge him, is he? He did ask him, when did he think we would get back to normal then, Professor Martin McKee?
I really don't know. I mean, I'm in the process of looking ahead at organising a major public health conference next year in November, and we're discussing that at the minute. I think that we will have returned to some degree of normality by the summer, but quite what will happen, and we're not going to be going back to the way we were before. People are not going to be travelling in the same way. People are not going to be going into the office in the same way.
He's fairly sure of all this, isn't he?
We've now discovered that we can have meetings on Zoom, but of course there are downsides to that too. So it's going to be a very different world from now on.
Very different world from now on, from now. How can you trust a man who can't say no? Just say no. It's not now. Say no. It's not that difficult, is it? No. From now on. 20 minutes or nearly 20 minutes past five. Here's a giggle. Here's a giggle. James O'Brien, LBC Radio. Everything that needs to be said about James O'Brien has been said. I'm not going to say another thing about him. He had a caller called, a caller by the name of Lee from Nottingham, I should say. Lee from Nottingham rang in. Lee's very upset because his wife is going down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole. Lee is really upset, so, well, what else would you do but phone James O'Brien?
I do love my wife, amazingly. She's an amazing person. But basically, recently, she started to get more and more anti-vax questioning, things of that nature. Right. We both agree on a hell of a lot of things. She reads your books. She thinks you're amazing. But I said to her, we just had another big bust up about it.
Is that why you're sounding a bit shaky?
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that, Lee. I really am.
I'm sorry to hear that. I've written it, but you're not. You couldn't give a shit, really. Lee's rung up James O'Brien, shaken because he's had a row with his wife, because his wife is starting to entertain or to read or to consider negative information about vaccine safety. So he's on with James O'Brien.
That's but I fully... Look, you're among friends, and I understand why you've rung in, all right?
We had a child recently, and she started questioning about vaccines, about what goes into them. And
anybody finds Lee's balls, Lee lives in Nottingham. I don't know exactly where in Nottingham he lives, but I'm sure the central police station there, if you find this man's testicles, put them in an envelope and mail them to Nottingham Central Police Station. Maybe Lee can go and pick them up.
It's like, well, that's a bit strange because we've never had problems asking about this before.
Yeah.
She has recently joined, I'm not going to mention the company, but one of these multi-level marketing schemes. One of her colleagues in it forwarded a piece of misinformation, which I said to her, that's completely false, and I'll show you why. I have a good friend. His daughter is a lecturer at a university in biology. I said, well, come and speak to them. And nothing. Even when you mentioned earlier on you were going to do that speech or the letter, I believe it was the thing that you're doing later on this evening, I said, why don't you listen in?
She just won't listen.
Yeah, the Media time. Society. I need to check that it's open to the public, actually. I should have done that before I started plugging it on her. But she hasn't got time anyway. So Mariana Springsworth at the BBC I'd refer you to, because she's really led the field on this.
Mariana Spring at the BBC. Mariana Spring is the BBC's disinformation reporter. There isn't anything more I can say about that. Mariana Spring, who is the BBC's fake news correspondent. The BBC's. And she's written on the BBC website quite a lot lately about anti-vaxxers and conspiracy theorists. So we have poor Lee from Nottingham, whose wife just won't listen, and his wife's going a bit crazy because she's reading anti-vaccine conspiracy material and Lee doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, and this is the thing. I mean, not trying to manage and forget Brexit. We both voted Remain. We both saw the tissue of lies and how everything was corrupted. The message that was going to people that fell for the sort of things.
Oh, stop, will you stop? Mr. T was listening to that, the great Mr. T, and he had this to say directly to Lee's wife. This is what he had to say to Lee's other half.
Hey, woman. Hey, woman. Listen here. Since your old man ain't got no heart, maybe you'd like to see a real man. I bet you stay up late every night dreaming you had a real man, don't you? I tell you what, bring your pretty little self over to my apartment tonight, and I'll show you a real man.
Absolutely right. Bring your pretty little self over to my apartment, and I'll show you a real man. This is Talking Heads on the Richie Allen Radio Show, back with my first guest in 3.5 minutes' time. Welcome!
You may find yourself living with a
Talking Heads on the Richie Allen Radio Show, 27.5 minutes. It is past 5 o'clock. Because the Richie Allen Radio Show is live, don't you know? You'll be listening to this later on podcast. It's a live radio show, and you can hear it live on the TuneIn app. A lot of people listen through TuneIn. A lot of people do that because it's a very famous app. We're still on there. Thousands and thousands of followers on the TuneIn app listening to the show every Monday to Thursday at 5 p.m. UK time. Live. And 3 o'clock on Friday. Live. I'm going to tell you maybe if there's time later on why I'm emphasising that. Somebody's had a pop at me today, and I found it kind of amusing. We might get into it a bit later on. We might not. Might not be worth our while. Do tweet the program. Do keep tweeting me. It's nice to read your tweets, by the way. A number of you amused by Lee phoning in to LBC Radio. Some of you amuse me. Some of the listeners to this program amuse me mightily. Some of you. Some of you are of the opinion that nothing is real, ever. Everything you hear is fake or set up or it's an actor. And it used to annoy me a lot. Now I just feel sorry for you. I'm really patronising you now. I'm properly patronising you. Those of you who think everything you hear is fake, is somebody acting, I don't know how you got to that place. But you're wrong. Not everything. Not everything is fake. I'm perfectly happy having heard 1,529 million people on the radio over the years, having listened intently to callers, phoning me, setting up phone calls for other people. I'm quite happy to listen to Lee today on LBC and believe that Lee is a genuine caller. Why not? Do you not realise that this level of programming, this level of abuse being dished out to the public by the media, it must have an effect on people? Of course it is. People are terrified. It's a genuine thing that people are lining up or queuing up for the vaccine. That's a real thing. The vast majority of people who I bump into, who I meet around Salford or Greater Manchester, they're desperately keen to get it, sadly. Because the majority of them get their information from the sources that I've been discussing earlier on. Now, let me introduce my guest, my first guest this afternoon. Delighted that she's agreed to come on the programme. She's a friend of the show's. I know her very well. We'll call her Emma today. Emma is a professional lady working for a very, very well-known and prestigious company. And she has a senior role there. And she sent me a message today about an exchange she was having with friends and others on social media. And she takes great care on social media because of her job. And she was talking to them about the prospect of having to take a vaccine against your will, because some of her friends and colleagues, former colleagues and colleagues, were saying, look, we're a bit worried we might lose our jobs if we don't consent to having this vaccine. So she's been looking into that, has Emma, and I'm delighted that she's agreed to come on and have a chat with us. Emma, welcome to the programme. Nice to talk to you again. How are you?
Hi, can you hear me okay?
I'm hearing you lovely. I hope you can hear me
Excellent.
Well.
Yeah, no, loud and clear.
Oh, that's great stuff. Hey, first of all, thanks for the email and thanks for agreeing to come on. I really appreciate it. Look, I wouldn't dream of buttering you up. I wouldn't dream of doing that. You're obviously a very bright woman. You're a successful woman. You've been watching this develop over the last 6, 8, 9 months like everybody else. When you heard Nadeem Zahawi, the vaccine minister, Emma, when he said, look, we think the private sector will probably, you know, put pressure on people, service providers to take the vaccine. Otherwise, well, you won't get the services. What did you think of that when you heard it?
Well, at the moment, as you know, the media is literally flooded with pitiful articles basically saying the same thing, and about the fact you won't be able to do this, that or the other without one. Basically, the premise being that your life is over if you don't submit. Oh, and you probably won't be able to go to work either. They've kind of been sort of dotting that one in around as well, which again is sort of, yeah, obviously terrifying people. And even the supposedly sort of articles that are supposed to offer a kind of balanced view and sort of questioning the ethics of mandatory vaccines. Even then, they're not really offering anything in terms of real cohesive arguments, more sort of kind of lame lip service, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So there's nothing around at the moment that's kind of really offering a solution. They're basically saying, oh, well, you know, we won't make them mandatory, but it's up to service providers, and they probably will, won't they? Because that would be such a sensible thing to do. So loads of my, or quite a few of my friends, and because I've been quite vocal about this since the beginning, have sort of asked me what I would do and what I think about it all. And so I basically promised that I would put together an argument strategy. So I tried to think of all the usual kind of questions that people find themselves up against, and particularly the ones that you keep kind of hearing over and over in the media. And then to counter those with actual official evidence from unarguable sources like the BMJ, Nature magazine, that kind of thing, to make a watertight argument. And another thing I would say is all the arguments are out there, all the evidence is out there, it's all in plain sight. And if you actually examine their own arguments, they're so nonsensical and weak, it's actually quite easy to go up against them, would be kind of my view on it.
It's easy to take them on.
So I set about putting together, yeah, all the things that I thought, yeah, they would sort of, you know, have to be subjected to.
And before we talk about one or two of these things, Emma, we're obviously not going to talk about what you do, of course not. But you have a good job. It is, yeah, a good job for, you know, for a very good company.
Yeah.
It might be the case, and regardless of what industry anybody's working in, it might very well be the case that employers, worried about, obviously, you know, what's been happening in the last few months, worried about the money that they've lost and the debt that they, yeah, have accrued. Some employers might jump on this and say, yeah, okay, if we can open up fully again, we will encourage our employees to have it. If you were, yeah, asked to have it, you'd be in a situation, I suppose, is it fair to say that you would say no, and or you would use the arguments that we're going to talk about now?
Yeah, no, 100%. There's no way I'd consent to it ever. And I don't want to lose my job. I love my job. Yeah, I've done it for a long time. I don't intend to give that up or to risk that, but by the same token, there's no way that I would agree to a vaccination either. So hence, obviously, I was quite motivated to come up with a really good argument, not just for my friends and sort of other people I know, but for me as well, because I'm not going to be taking it, you know, no matter what.
And you've broken it down. You've broken it down into three or four. Well, actually, several questions are very interesting questions.
Yeah.
Things that might be expressed to some employee somewhere. So a boss or a supervisor or somebody might say, hey, Emma, you'll have to have the vaccine or you will lose your job. That's number one. And you've got an answer for that.
I have. So all the vaccines so far against this virus, they're still on trial. So Pfizer, for instance, won't be completed until January 29th, 2023. So make no mistake, you are, if you do agree to the vaccine, you're essentially part of an ongoing trial, part of an ongoing experiment. And they're also all by definition novel. No candidate vaccine's ever been in development for more than a few months.
Yeah.
And quite a few of them, you know, use novel technology, even novel kind of transportation mechanisms, whereby they have to be stored at some ridiculously low temperature, you know, minus 80 degrees, I think it is, for one of them at least. So I would say that's when you would bring out the human rights aspects and the Nuremberg Code. And that's very specific in the language they use in terms of that you can't be part of a medical experiment unless there is informed consent. And I won't go into the ins and out of it, but essentially you have to have informed consent. and you can't coerce somebody into doing it. And coercion means, you know, would certainly mean threatening them with the loss of their job. And informed consent, you know, means the absolute, you know, entitlement to say no, should you want to.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say to that.
That's important, isn't it, now, that Nuremberg Code? Because I don't know if you heard any of the news roundup, but the Prime Minister himself specifically stated today they've telescoped, I think, I'm paraphrasing him now, they've telescoped 10 years worth of research into 10 months, Emma. I mean, that's a massive red flag to somebody like me.
Of course it is. You'd be absolutely, I mean, I think, you know, anybody, even sort of, you know, somebody very pro-vaccine would have to be sort of fairly insane to just, you know, agree to something like that. You know, everybody, it's been quite like, again, widely in the mainstream, how long a vaccine normally takes to develop, and it's usually in the region of sort of, you know, 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And that's, again, that's been put out there. So it's not like this is kind of hidden knowledge. It's very much out in the open that that's how long. And you can't just, you know, as Boris says, you can't just, you know, condense all that research and time and trials and, you know, into 10 months. That's absolutely ludicrous. What a ludicrous thing to say.
Before we go to the second thing that might be said to an employee, this is great work, by the way, Emma. Thanks for it. It's brilliant stuff, this.
No, you're
thanks
welcome.
For, no, it's great stuff. Before we get to that, I have a theory. I'm probably going to be proved wrong, as would be the norm, but I have this thing. A lot of people, I think, won't take the vaccine, and it's not because they are independent media consumers. I think many of them will know that this is brand new and will know that this has been developed very quickly. And I think a lot of Middle England, maybe, if I can use that term, might say, no, we won't have it. We'll wait and see how it affects other people. I think that might be a possibility. What do you think?
Oh, totally. I mean, that's a fairly, you know, sort of, however pro-vaccine you are, that's a fairly sensible position to take, isn't it? You know, I mean, how could anybody argue with that? You've got novel technology being used. It's being rolled out very, very expeditiously. Most people aren't at any risk from it at all. So why would you take an experimental vaccine? You know, it does, and when you have no idea of the sort of any kind of long-term data studies or safety studies.
Yeah.
You know, that I would say that was a really sensible option. They're kind of almost pathologizing that attitude as though that's some kind of, oh, look at those people, you know, who don't want to take this experimental vaccine. They want to see other people take it first. Yeah. And as for the newsreaders who are kind of claiming that they would have it and they'd be first in, you know, in the queue for it, rubbish.
You don't believe them.
I don't believe that for a second.
No, neither do I. And I've been around enough of radio and television presenters for the last 20 years to know that most of them are lying. It's virtue signalling. We've got Emma on the line. Emma is a friend of the programmes, and I know who Emma is, and for obvious reasons, Emma needs to protect her identity. She works for a stellar international company. She has a senior role there. She's very well thought of, and she thinks very highly of her company, it must be said. And listening to friends and others expressing their concerns about being coerced into having a vaccine, Emma put her brain to work and started looking at some of the things that you might be told and what you might say back. Now, we've already gone over the you must be vaccinated or you will lose your job. And Emma said, look, without getting into the finer details of the Nuremberg Code here, but you can't be compelled to take something that's experimental. You can't be compelled to do that. It's a great answer. It's very succinct. Now, you might be told by somebody that your own right, Emma, to autonomy over your own body, right, and not to be part of ongoing experiments doesn't include your right to infect others. So basically, bodily autonomy, they might say, you can't claim that anymore because by not taking the medicine or the vaccine, you're actually harming other people. It's not just about you. You've got an answer for that.
Yeah, so that's a really common argument, especially it's been used within the media, and I've heard a couple of MPs saying that as well, that you don't have a right to infect others. And it's very emotive language, but it's actually hypothetical and it's pseudoscientific and very manipulative. And to that, I would basically put forward the article from the BMJ that was written by Peter Doshi, who's an assistant editor. So this isn't Mrs. Jones at the post office who's saying this. And he basically very clearly explained that none of the trials, that's none of them, are designed to detect a reduction either in serious outcomes such as hospital admissions or death, and nor, which is the most important point from their argument, is that there are the vaccines being studied to determine whether they can interrupt the transmission of the virus. You know, so they're not even looking at that. And additionally, Moderna's chief medical officer, he also stated that they don't show that they prevent you from potentially carrying this virus transiently and infecting others. They're not even, the trials weren't even designed to look at that.
That's very important. Now, can we double down on that? That's hugely important. What Emma just said there is absolutely true. The chief medical officer of Moderna said vaccines, the mRNA vaccines do not show that they prevent you from potentially carrying this virus transiently and infecting others, which blows that argument out of the water that you should have it to protect others. They admit themselves that you having it will or not having it won't have any effect on others.
No, and the reality is that even according to their own data, so I specifically looked at the Pfizer one, and yeah, which is, I think they did over 40,000 participants. And it basically, you've got a 0.7% absolute risk reduction in the end user only. So that's for yourself. You've got a 0.76% reduction in possibly, developing mild cold symptoms. Yeah, that's the reality of it. And that's even if you believe their data, which, I would treat quite a lot of suspicions, because Pfizer haven't got the best track record in being honest and upfront, about their trials. And another thing I'd add, and this is speculative on my part, but I'd also, from where they're a trial of that size, all their kind of, effectively their kind of, their trial stations will be scattered all over the place. And there's very, very little in terms of standardization between the sort of test centres and also the, from where we're ascertaining whether they've actually got the virus or not.
Yeah.
There's some test centres will use so many cycles, and so a certain cycle threshold, and other test centres will have one that's a lot higher. So unless you know what kind of cycle threshold the placebo group's been subjected to and what kind of cycle threshold the actual vaccine has been subjected to, how can you really trust whether they were positive results or not in terms of the people that supposedly developed the virus against the ones that didn't? Am I making sense there?
You're making perfect sense. It's maddening to hear somebody like yourself asking these questions and making these points and listening to the Pfizer people, the Moderna people, all of whom have been on television in the UK recently, and they are not being asked these questions by UK television presenters. It's astonishing.
It's the basic, it's so important, isn't it? Because, you've got a cycle threshold of 60, everyone's going to test positive. You've got a cycle threshold of 15, probably nobody would test positive. Yeah. So it all depends, how they, it'd be very, very easy to manipulate the data, put it that way. Because I'm quite slightly suspicious of this 90%, which essentially means that out of 40-odd thousand, 160 or 170 people developed, cold symptoms, of which resulted in a positive test, and 8 of which were in the vaccine group and 162 were in the placebo group. I'm a little bit sceptical of that, because unless you have visibility on how they came to those results and what, their parameters were.
And Vernon Coleman made a very good point on this programme as well, which has to be mentioned here. The placebo isn't a placebo.
No, of course not.
It's a vaccine. It's another vaccine, and that's not a genuine placebo. So again, it throws him. The veracity, I suppose, of these results right up in the air, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course it does. And they often use the argument that they use another vaccine as a placebo, but it feels like a genuine vaccine.
Yeah.
When you get it, in that there will be side effects, or you'll get swelling and all sorts of things, but. I mean, so again, how can you possibly, especially in a safety trial, you have to compare it with, a completely inert solution. You can't possibly compare it with another vaccine that's, not going to be 100% safe itself. It's just ludicrous.
The vast majority of people in this country.
And again, it's quite hard to get that information.
Well, it is.
What the placebo was that they used.
Yeah, this is it. But again, you shouldn't have to do it, Emma. You shouldn't have to do it. The aforementioned BBC presenters, Radio 4, BBC Breakfast, these presenters should be asking these questions. And you don't have to be you don't have to be a 20-year career journalist to know that these are questions you should be asking. Emma is on the programme this afternoon. If you're just joining us, let me give you the full picture. Emma is somebody I know, listens to this programme, professional woman working for a very prestigious company in a senior role, and has been speaking to a lot of people, colleagues and friends alike, about the possibility of having to take a vaccine that you don't want to take in order not to lose your job. And of course, later on, in order to be able to go out and about and socialise and all of that. So we've been running through some of the things that employers and service providers might say to their employees. And she's been putting some very good arguments against the things that you might be told. One of them, of course, is the asymptomatic spread claim. And this is maddening, this. I mean, they're testing people that are fine for the virus. You've explained, Emma, why the PCR test is so redundant. People are absolutely fine, nothing really wrong with them, and they're being told that they've got the virus. And we've been told now for, well, I suppose since the outset of this, we've been told that, yeah, asymptomatic people, whether you're sick or not, you can transmit that virus. You can make somebody vulnerable sick, and therefore you should have the vaccine. But you've got an answer.
Yeah, as I said, in terms of the most sort of insidious, damaging, or societal damaging arguments that they've come up with is this idea of asymptomatic spread, which is just theory and conjecture. I mean, they have a hard enough time proving symptomatic spread or symptomatic transmission, let alone asymptomatic transmission. And now there have been two really good studies. So the first one came out a few months ago, and it was essentially in PubMed, and they looked at the close contacts, or 455 of the close contacts of this asymptomatic person, and none of them, developed, either tested positive as an asymptomatic person or developed symptoms. And even Fauci has, he's come out himself and admitted that, or stated quite publicly, that asymptomatic transmission is never the driver of a pandemic.
Yeah.
At least translation. And WHO also said, it's asymptomatic transmission is very rare. But the really good thing that's come out recently in terms of a case for us is that a study from Wuhan, which is featured in Nature magazine, and Nature is a very official magazine. It's sort of, almost like the Bible of the science. And in that study, I think 9 million or over 9 million people were looked at, and they had 300 people showing who's tested positive who are asymptomatic, and not a single contact of them. And they followed all the contacts very closely, and not a single contact of these 300 asymptomatic people out of 9 million tested positive. And so from that, they obviously concluded that asymptomatic transmission really isn't a thing. Yeah, it's what is dictating so much of our lives, and it's basically made the lives of old people utterly miserable for the last 9 months.
It sounds like it's belting it down there where you are, Emma, is it? It sounds like it's the weather is taking a turn for the worse there.
Is that better?
Yeah, fine. Yeah, no, it just sounded like I thought I heard raindrops belting off.
Oh, sorry. No, I thought I heard raindrops on your end, so it might have been the line.
Ah, it could be the line. Yeah, yeah. No, I'm tucked away in a very warm studio here in Salford.
It's nice.
That's a great
great
argument. And yeah, you're right. Fauci said it. The asymptomatic transmission has never been the driver of outbreaks. Fauci himself said it. The driver of outbreaks is always a symptomatic person, somebody who's showing symptoms. Important arguments, these. You might be told that your company, your business is constrained by the requirements of other countries and organisations, meaning you can't fulfil your role unless you are vaccinated. That is something which might be said to people.
Yes, so quite a few people where I work have come forward with that they just simply can't do their job because of third party constraints and diktats. So I would say to that, you obviously know about the MHRA study, or Tenet rather, that they basically put it out to tender, for an AI, device, for want of a better word, to cope with the expected high volumes of adverse events that they're going to be getting from the COVID vaccine. So clearly there are anticipated volumes of, damage and possibly death and who knows what other sort of, quite serious side effects they're expecting from this. And I would say, as a company, they've got a duty of care to their employees, which means they need to take all steps which are reasonably possible to ensure that the health and safety of well-being of their employees. And they should be abiding by sort of relevant health and safety. And they've also got a moral and ethical duty not to cause physical or psychological injury, and also that they are liable for regard to personal injury, which you essentially suffer while performing your role. So as a company, obviously they're not going to be one to be liable for an unknown amount of adverse reactions. So they should therefore provide dispensation, because a lot of companies you'll find in these sort of kind of situations, you don't get, as an employee, you get treated completely differently than you would, say, a service user, and you get a dispensation for these things. It means you don't have to continually subject yourself to the, you know, other things that, yeah, the end user is going to be maybe subjected to, because you don't have a choice as an employee, and they've got a duty of care towards you. So I would say to that, provide, yeah, assuming you get all the way through those arguments, and they turn around and say to you, look, you still have to have it because, you know, XYZ said you had to, therefore you must. Well, no, it's then up to the company to provide a dispensation, which they can and do, and they do it for all sorts of things. So there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to do that in this situation as well, especially as the likelihood of harm is, you know, demonstrably quite high.
Yeah, it's amazing that, isn't it? I mean, again, it should have been headline news, the MHRA statement that we expect high volumes of adverse events. So after we start injecting this vaccine into people, we expect, you know, a great deal of people, or a large volume of people, to become unwell from it. It's, again, it should have been headline news. It's one of those stop the presses things, but it wasn't. It's hardly gotten a mention, really, on mainstream media here in the UK. And when I announced this afternoon that Emma was coming on, I had several emails and tweets from people who work in businesses, and their business takes them around Europe. It takes them on the Channel Tunnel. It takes them into Europe, into France, into Brussels. It takes them through airports all over the country. And they were very concerned about that one as well, about companies saying to them, like, you know, we do business a lot overseas. We've got to take other countries' rules and regulations into consideration. So, sorry, but you will have to have the vaccine. Probably a dozen business people said to me today.
I can imagine. Yeah, that's a real concern, because it's almost something that you kind of feel is out of the company's control, but it isn't. They can petition, especially, you know, there's such strong arguments for it. So they can petition for a dispensation for that, for their employees. That's not an issue, and it's something that they do all the time. For all sorts of different, I can't really sort of say, I mean, my company does it a lot. So I can't really say what the particulars, because without giving myself away. But they often provide dispensations for, you know, particularly for members of staff.
You also mentioned
different.
Sorry, I mean, you also mentioned as well, and this is always a controversial one. It's basically the proof of the existence of the virus itself. And I suppose somebody of your intelligence and education, maybe you're a bit reluctant maybe to get into that one, but you do anyway. And you say, like, you might ask your company, you know, somebody might ask their company, look, can you even show me that this thing exists? But I think that's probably a last resort. But I get that a lot, you know.
Could do. If you're pushed really backed into a corner, you could go down that line of inquiry, because there's been enough freedom of information requests now. That none of this kind of information is really readily available, which it really should be. Yeah, we're 9 months, nearly 10 months into this, pantomime. That information should be readily and freely available. If it isn't, then it begs the question, why not?
Why not? And
so you could use that. You could definitely go down that route. I would say if you want it as part of your fair and reasonable kind of request. Strategy, if that makes sense.
It's funny, though, because I do genuinely, when I say I meet people, I mean, look, like every other Irish man and woman alive, we are prone to the odd bit of exaggeration, and that's what we do in Ireland. And I'm guilty from time to time of exaggerating, but when I say I meet people and I have these discussions, I do. And for the most part, I suppose nowadays, most of the people I meet, they know that I'm a journalist and what I do for a living, but quite a few still don't. And I would say to them, you know, how are you getting on? What do you think of all of this? And how's it affecting you? And of course, I don't browbeat them with my opinion. I just ask them, how are you getting on? And I would say things like, are you not the least bit suspicious that flu seems to have disappeared off the face of the earth? And they look at me and they're like, and what do you mean? I say, well, I could show you an article if you wanted, a regular newspaper article, that shows that incidences of flu and flu deaths have just basically gone down, diminished completely. Would that not make you wonder if coronavirus, at least sometimes, is actually the flu and it's being diagnosed as coronavirus? And this is what saddens me, Emma. I don't know if you've had this experience. They look at me with glassy eyes and shake their heads. And it's like, no, I don't want to hear that.
One of the most devastating things is just realising how unquestioning people are in general, that they just accept this thing, all these things that make no sense at all. And there's continually contradictory information out there in the in the media, you know, not least about sort of old people, you know. And I mean, there's been quite a few articles now about how old people have essentially died of isolation and loneliness, and people with dementia have effectively, through the lack of stimulation, have died of dehydration. Yet they're then told, on the other hand, oh, but we must isolate your elderly people. And they're like, oh, okay. And it's almost like all that kind of information, all the hard evidence is forgotten in favour of this hypothesis and this conjecture and this kind of sort of made up stuff that nobody really knows. I find it incredible that people aren't asking more questions. Yeah, and fairly obvious questions like, you know, where's flu gone? You know, excess deaths. What are we looking at here? And if people are dying of isolation, and how many people are dying? You know, I find it incredible how people aren't asking more questions, to be honest. And yet it's everywhere.
While Rome is burning, while people's businesses are disappearing in front of their eyes.
I know. I literally cannot get my head around the sort of and the lack of challenge as well. You know, the lack of, people are just kind of just putting up with it. And there are so many really good arguments against all of this, yet nobody's really using them. Nobody seems to be challenging any of this in their sort of own lives. It just makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Will you have friends, Emma? Will you have friends, or do you have friends with their own businesses who are suffering because of this?
Yeah, no, totally. I've got friends whose businesses are on their knees because of this. And because I'm quite outspoken about it, and I have been, you know, since March. So a lot of my friends have heard me sort of twitching on about it, and they're kind of sort of almost getting it. Not all my friends, but the ones that I speak to, that they know it's nonsense, but they almost feel sort of browbeaten into submission. And again, you know, the media's been absolutely woeful. So rather than kind of asking these really good questions about what the MHRA has said, or what Fauci's been saying, they're pontificating on which celebrity should be used to push the vaccine. It's just incredible.
We spoke about this earlier on. Just again, let me just remind, we've got about 5-6 minutes left. But just for listeners who've come in, Emma is on the line to me from the UK, friend of the programmes, gotten to know her in the last couple of years. I can vouch for Emma. I know who she is. She's a successful businesswoman in a senior role at a very prestigious and very well-known company. She's well thought of, and she's fond of her company. But here we are, you know, Emma has to be Emma today, because, you know, a lot of people, and it's a point I wanted to come to, it's courageous you even doing this and coming on and talking about this and doing that research. But a lot of people are genuinely, I think, worried that to say anything, particularly on social media, might have serious adverse consequences for them. Like, I'd love to go on. I met a guy recently, not very recently, but, you know, in the middle of all of this, probably back in August, September, I met a guy, and he's an employee of a local authority somewhere in Greater Manchester. And he thinks it's nonsense, Emma. He understands it. And he said to me, Richie, I'll be fired if I go on social media, even if it's moderate, even if I go on and say, look, I found this bit of information, have a look at it. I'm not sure about these excess deaths. I'm not sure about it. He said, I'll be done. And I'm guessing a lot of the people you encounter, they must have that fear as well. If I say anything, it could screw my career.
Yeah, I mean, there's that pressure, which is really real. And there's also the kind of sort of peer pressure as well. I've had people private message me, my friends, that they can't like what I've, like in inverted commas, anything I've written, just in case somebody sees it and they can't be seen to be liking something. But they say, private message me and said, oh, you know, thanks for sort of saying, what I've been feeling. And I really appreciate it, but I can't actually like it, because, I've got friends who'd be horrified if I liked, a post like that. It's just insane, the sort of societal pressure that's been put on people. And absolutely, people are scared to speak out. Yeah, as you know, I was quite sort of nervous coming on with you today and talking about it. Which is what a crazy situation that you can't sort of feel that you can come out and quote articles from the British Medical Journal, or what people have been saying, chief executives from vaccine companies are saying, through fear of there being consequences. It's just a crazy situation we're in.
What does that do? Can I make it a little bit more personal for a moment?
Yeah, of course.
For somebody like yourself, and a successful career woman, I'm sure you made plenty of sacrifices along the way. And like you said, you love your job, you love your company. Do you ever think we'd be here where we are now? Because I'm going to be honest, I probably did, but I didn't see this level of dystopia probably for another couple of decades. I thought I'd be gone, Emma, to be honest. Did you see this? Did you? How do you? I say this to people all the time when I meet them. How is it making you feel? I mean, how do you cope with it?
I had no idea it would happen so quickly, because you always kind of know. I mean, sort of, you're aware of a sort of like a slowly moving agenda. But I had no idea how quickly it would move. And I always thought as well that if things became incredibly obvious, like I feel they are at the moment, that people would just wake up and realise, yeah, I'm not putting up with this nonsense. This is crazy. This doesn't make sense. Because all the information is there, but nobody seems to be looking at it. And I never really expected, I guess that's been the biggest shock for me, that people just that are just going along with it. But I never saw this coming. I never expected this. And I certainly didn't, in terms of it just happening so quickly. And such devastation as well. You know, I mean, it's absolutely devastating what's happening, and people are just kind of, you know, oh, well, you know, and not really, there's not been that much of a pushback, not really. Not consider if you take it in terms of the devastation that's been caused.
Yeah.
So I find it incredibly, incredibly depressing. And in terms of how I cope, I think I get stressed when I don't see that there's a way out. So I guess, you know, formulating my little list helps me, because I kind of think then I've got a certain amount of, you think, well, that's, yeah, I've got a good argument against this. And so kind of doing what you can to stay positive, because I think a lot of it is really incredibly depressing for people. And I sometimes wonder, with the sort of relentless kind of media pushing and doom-mongering, that isn't somehow part of the strategy to make so people so hopelessly resigned and depressed.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I can see that in a lot of people, though. A lot of people I know are fairly upbeat normally, are really, really down about this.
So I suppose the last question I'll ask you, by the way, with your permission, and I will not give any clues whatsoever to your identity. But what I'll do with your, I mean, I don't have much of a Facebook following, because we don't use it very much, really. But I would like to copy and paste that, if that's okay, and put it on Facebook. 100%. Because it's brilliant. It reads, I mean, you explained it beautifully, but it also reads well. And of course, the links are there. You put all the links. I mean, you know, a lot of people come to me, and of course, you didn't ask, nor did you want to come on the program. I kind of coerced, to use that word, I coerced you to come on the program. But a lot of people, they send me information and stuff. I've never had anything presented as well as that. It's fantastic. It's a journalist dream, really, Emma.
That's really kind.
Not at all. So I'll ask you then. First of all, thanks for sharing your time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Anytime. I'm sure we'll do it again in the near future. We've talked about how dreadful it is, and it's been very good news today. You saying, look, this is what you can say. These are the things you can do with your employers. That's marvellous. Glass half full, glass half empty, Emma. Do you think we've got a chance of turning it around?
I do. I really do. Mainly because their kind of evidence and strategy is so utterly woeful. All the evidence against it is all out there. If people just look, it's all there in plain sight. You know, every single, you know, just sort of like, you know, the basic list that we've gone through tonight. It's very hard to argue against.
Yeah.
Whereas their argument's extremely weak. Oh, you have to get the vaccine, otherwise you're infected. Others, well, you know, what part of the BMJ article do you have an issue with? Do you not agree with? You know, it's very solid. That article in itself, you know, completely explodes their kind of reasoning that you have to have it to protect others. You know, this kind of sort of very manipulative argument they've been using all along, when the actual reality is that they've done everything they possibly can not to protect, you know, elderly and vulnerable people. It's just a case of, I think, and I also think as it gets closer, and I'm really heartened by the fact that more and more people are coming out and saying they wouldn't have it. They wouldn't have, you can't really say it, can you? have the thing that everybody wants them to have. You know, more and more people are getting really sceptical and quite twitty about it, and I think that's a great thing. To be honest with you, I am hopeful. I still am hopeful that, you know, that truth will prevail, as it were. As I say, you know, and as slow as it is, and as depressed as I get, you know, when you go out and everybody's wearing a mask and I'm the only one not, and it's really...
Has anybody challenged you, Emma? Has anybody said, hey, missus, what's going on? Where's your mask? Have you had any of that nonsense?
No, apart from, obviously, you know, the bouncers on a well-known supermarket, you know, slightly question you. Yeah. And all you have to do is say the magic word, I'm exempt, and that sort of ends that conversation.
Yeah.
But in terms of people on the street, no, absolutely nothing. And I was really worried about that at first, because Cressida Dick, you obviously gave the impression that you're going to be essentially pelted with eggs if you went out without a mask. And that's absolutely rubbish. Nobody says anything to you. And I would say almost that I definitely noticed a bit of glaring at me, you know, peripheral glaring, when it first started. But I'd say now people like the fact that they can see your face, and especially, you know, people at the till. They love the fact that they can smile at you and you can smile back.
Yeah.
So I make a point now, rather than avoiding eye contact, which I did in the beginning, I make a point of smiling at people, you know, and just pushing through it now.
Fantastic. Listen, it's been great to speak to you. We swapped emails in the past, you and I, and I knew a little bit about you. So it's great to chat with you. You've done us a big favour today.
Richie, thank you.
Not at all. And you're welcome back anytime, Emma, and look after yourself.
No, you too. Thanks again, Richie. Take care.
Not at all. Bye for now. Lovely to speak with Emma. Emma is a woman who works in a senior role at a very, very big company and is well-known and well-liked and is not happy with what's been happening, and wrote a fantastic post. She manages to do this within her own circle of friends. She can't be identified. Where basically she was able to present an argument against the state's argument, or maybe your employer's argument, as to why you should have a vaccine. And she did a fabulous job of it. What I'll do, I won't do it now, because if I copy and paste it now, I might leave in something that gives a clue to Emma's identity. I won't do it now. But after the show, I will make sure that there's no incriminating information there, and I will copy and paste it. It's very good. And all of the links are contained within. It's exactly 8 minutes past six. You are listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show. It is live, as always. I'm in Salford, the great city of Salford, here in the northwest. Winter. It's December 1st, isn't it? We're 24 days away from Santa. Yeah. Right, I tell you what I'm going to do. Am I going to do it? Am I going to do it or what? Am I going to do it? Yes, I'm going to take headlines. I'm going to take some headlines. Before I take headlines, let me tell you that none other than Posy Parker returns to the Richie Allen Radio Show. She'll be with me in around about, well, just under 10 minutes' time. That's, of course, about Tavistock Institute and the High Court decision today. The children under 16 need to be better informed about puberty-blocking drugs. We're talking about children with gender dysphoria, body dysmorphia, however you want to say it. A very interesting and very, very, very important story. So we'll talk to her about that shortly. Before that, though, we will, of course, have the headlines from FSN on your Richie Allen Radio Show. Is it Simon?
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. President Trump is telling the Republican governor of Georgia to cancel two upcoming runoff elections for the state's seats in the U.S. Senate. That isn't going to happen. The Debenhams department store, a fixture on British High Street since the 1800s, is to close. And a Chinese space probe has landed on the moon, where it will collect lunar rocks. The first time man has made that happen in 44 years.
Thanks very much, Simon. You can keep tweeting the programme, by the way, as you do, at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. RichieAllen.co.uk is very outdated, isn't it? It's been in development for some time now. My great friend and colleague Hayden Hewitt is the man behind it. He's doing a sterling job. I'm hoping that we'll get it launched this side of Christmas. And we'll have a brand new, flashy website. Let's do that. Speaking of Hayden Hewitt, I'll be on the telly with him real soon. In fact, I think it might be this Thursday. It very well might be.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbyerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Lovely. By the way, I told you that I was going to be speaking to Angelo John Gage today. I was due to be speaking to Angelo, but I've asked him to reschedule that. We're going to speak next week. He's an author and a broadcaster. Very interesting guy. He'll be on with me next week. It's to do with the Tavistock thing and obviously the coronavirus thing. So we'll have a chat with him next week. Angelo, he got in touch with me a few weeks ago and I was looking into him. Interesting guy. Hi to John Hardy, man. How you doing, John? I do know about Rachel Elno, John. Thanks. Rachel Elno, I think. Is that how you pronounce the surname? Elno. I know she was one of the original dragons on Dragon's Den. And I know that some months ago she was scathing in her criticism of lockdown. I did reach out to her and she wouldn't come on, which is fair enough. It happens all the time. I told you this before. There are people who I would invite on. They wouldn't know very much about me, if anything. They wouldn't know anything. In many cases, they wouldn't know anything. And sadly for me and for you, they might go looking at my, they might look up my name on a search engine. And there they obviously will find articles in the press that were critical of me, not for anything I said or did, but because I had certain people on the programme over the years. So some potential guests will look at that and will say, no thanks, I don't want to go on your programme because I might get criticised for it, sadly. Now, I'm not saying that's the case with Rachel Elno. I'm not saying that at all. But she gave me a short, sharp no. So there you are. Love to have you on. No. All right. Fair enough. Be Jesus. Don't let me down gently. Anyway, whatever you do, you know. Whatever you do. Tomorrow, Thursday, having a Scooby-Doo. Who's on? Because I don't have the diary to hand, but I'm sure it'll be interesting anyway. Right. Oakley dokily. We shall be speaking in a couple of moments' time to none other, as I said, than Pokey. Jesus, Richie. It's only Tuesday. To Posey Parker. Yes, that's her pen name. She is, of course, known. Her real name is Kelly J. Keane Minchell. Very well known for standing up to, well, the sort of nonsense that we've been talking about now for so many years. It feels like years. People being deplatformed. People being threatened. People getting visited by the old bill. She was visited by the old bill because she refused to accept that a man who identifies as a woman is a real woman. So she became very well known for all of that. She'll be with me in a minute. That story is very interesting. High Court in the UK today ruling that children under 16 with gender dysphoria are unlikely to be able to give informed consent to undergo treatment with puberty-blocking drugs. One of the claimants, this is all about the Tavistock and Portman NHS Trust. One of the claimants, Kira Bell, said she was delighted by the ruling and that it would help protect vulnerable teenagers. She basically said she suffered or was dealing with gender dysphoria, born a girl, wanted to transition to be a boy, got involved with all of that, the Tavistock, the puberty blockers and all of that, and changed her mind and wished that they'd be more helpful and more, how do I say this? She stated that they should have been more caring in terms of how she was dealt with in I'm just going to shut up. We'll talk to Posey Parker about it in a minute. Basically, they could have done a lot more for her than just put her on the puberty blocking drugs. They could have looked deeper into what was going on with her, but they didn't. They paved the way for the drugs. Big story this. We'll have a tune. It's Little Richard. Go to town and move, right, that is Little Richard on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Long Tall Sally, 17 minutes past 6. Just before we welcome Posey back to the programme, comment there from JJ. How you doing, JJ? Richie, going back to your comment about James O'Brien's caller, Lee from Nottingham. I'm not sure, Richie, you can say the caller wasn't an actor any more than some of your listeners can say that he was. The propaganda is off the scale for the vaccine agenda, says JJ. Well, JJ, I've never been arrogant, but I've interviewed thousands of people working in national, commercial and independent radio and television for years. I've heard thousands of people. I am more qualified than the average listener to this programme to determine whether a phone call to a radio station is genuine or whether it's been set up. It doesn't mean I'm right, but I've earned the right to that opinion, I would argue. Anyway, listen, let's get into this because it's very important. Big news this today. Children under 16 with gender dysphoria are unlikely to be able to give informed consent to undergo treatment with puberty-blocking drugs. High Court judges, three of them, ruled. The case was brought against Tavistock and Portman NHS Trust. I mentioned Ciara Bell already. Ciara argued that the clinic should have done more to challenge her over her decision to transition to a male, but they didn't. And this is big. The implications of it are big. Now, the trust, Tavistock, has said, well, we're going to appeal this. Let's welcome back to the programme a feminist campaigner who has been dubbed one of the UK's most prominent gender-critical feminists. She was interviewed by the police under caution for expressing an opinion on Twitter. She was banned on Twitter. Her family were threatened. Terrible things. But yet, through all of that, she's kept, a proper cheery disposition and outlook and has continued to campaign and to appear and speak out on these issues, which I have great admiration for. Let's welcome back to the programme, Posy Parker. Posy, welcome back. How are you doing?
Oh, yeah, I'm great. Thank you very much for having me.
It's good to have you on. Before we get talking about this, because it's very serious, the last time we spoke was in July. How are you dealing and your family dealing with the lockdown and all that goes with that? How are you coping with all of that?
I'm not going to lie. I've been with my husband for 22 years and I still really like him. So I've enjoyed every second. The kids, not so much. I think actually long-term impact on children not having normal lives is something that we can't quantify at the moment. I just don't think it's great for them at all. I think they're supposed to make mistakes and they can't do it because they can't go anywhere.
What about elderly relatives now? What about grannies and granddads?
Well, I'm a little bit of a weird age. So my parents are quite young and I don't have any grandparents. My husband's parents aren't very well at all, actually. So that's been a bit difficult because they live quite far away. And when we're in the sort of strictest bit of lockdown, he obviously can't go and see them.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. Genuinely, it can't be easy. And I hope their health improves, Posy. This story, you've been following it as close as anybody else. Ciara Bell, delighted by the ruling today, the three High Court judges. Mm. How significant is that decision, do you think?
I think it's the first domino to fall, to be honest. I think when we can actually say in a court of law something that most normal people actually know, that children can't consent, and the implications of saying that children can consent to adult life-altering decisions, I think we're in really sticky, nasty territory. And so it's an absolute relief that the court has made this decision. Obviously, it can't heal the bodies that have already been damaged, which I hope this is some small consolation for those people who are living with the most profound regret that actually no other child, realistically, no other child is going to be able to access those drugs, because it's going to be a very difficult case to take to court to convince a panel of judges that somebody under the age of 16 genuinely understands what life will be like without access to a healthy sexual relationship, or with increased risks of many long-term illnesses and chronic conditions. So I think it's good news. I don't think it goes far enough for me. I would really like to see us criminalise people that do prescribe these drugs, but, you know, one step at a time.
Would you? You'd like to see them criminalised? We'll come back to that in a moment. we'll come back to that. Yeah, because obviously today the media does what the media does. Mm-hmm. And I spend a lot of time beating up Sky News on this particular programme. But today I thought they were pretty fair. They found one or two youngsters who had a different experience to that of Ciara and who are delighted that they went through it and delighted they got the puberty blockers. So what I would ask you is, do you not think that there might be some room for this? That they could be made? I mean, Ciara said, look, they should have done more to ensure that this was right for me and that this was the only option. Is there any room for the Tavistock Centre I mean, it's the only one in the country at the moment, the only gender identity development service. It's the only one. Is there room for them to get their house in order and to provide that service for people who maybe do really need it? Or do you think it's taboo, it just should never happen?
I think it should never happen, and I'll tell you why. Because during the age of adolescence, which can nowadays stretch on to, for some people, way into their 30s, but let's say absolutely physiologically, globally, adolescence is from puberty to adulthood. And adulthood, let's mark it at 21. And we know that the brain continues developing until it's 23, 25. How can we possibly ever say that what somebody wants to do at 15 is going to remain a solid belief, a fundamental belief in what they want to do at 23?
Yeah.
Additionally, Richie, I really don't believe that anybody is born in the wrong body. I really, really don't believe that the solution for anybody ever, is to try and aim for something that is absolutely impossible. You can't change sex.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, we don't let anybody do anything else where we pretend that they will transform into something that they won't. It's quite incredible that we ever use such terms as changing sex, transition. These things don't happen.
Let me say this on that. There is a woman called Diane who hails from Wales and is living in Ireland at the moment. Diane's been on this programme. Lovely, lovely person. Was born a man. Now, Diane has got a lot of problems with many of the things you have problems with. Huge problems with these things. She's certainly no, you know, transsexual activist or any of that. She would agree with and see the world very similar to you. Now, if Diane is listening, please, I know she might be, please correct me on Twitter. But Diane had the surgery. We had a lovely conversation about it. Some years ago now, it must be said, not recently. Diane would be middle-aged. And she said to me that life would have been unbearable without the surgery. Would have been unbearable.
I don't know if we know that, do we? I mean, these are unquantifiable things. I'm sure that sometimes people with certain traumas or life-altering situations, they can focus on something that they then believe is going to dramatically change their lives. I recently watched Eddie Izzard, who's fallen off the comedy circuit.
Yeah.
And I watched him talking about how he knows he's got male and female genetics. There's a lot of people that seem to know a lot of things that aren't actually true.
Fair enough. But the again, I don't want to say this because Diane might go through me for a shortcut next time I speak to her, because I might not be explaining her situation. But she lives very happily now with her partner, has a great life, is very happy, very together, and I suppose the gender dysphoria, she was very, very forthcoming discussing that with me and said that that was a very serious thing for her. And she had to deal with that. And surgery was the right option for her, and she's never looked back and she's happy.
But you don't really change sex, though, do you? So with respect, and I'm delighted if someone has whatever surgeries and thinks that they've found happiness as a solution, it's not real.
Well, she's not going around insisting that people refer to her as a woman. She's not involved in any of that nonsense at all. The decision was made because there was no life without it for her. And like I said, she's a little bit older. We're talking 50s, we're talking late 50s. And like I said, importantly, a lot of the stuff that we see now, trans people trying to get access to female spaces, Diane wouldn't tolerate it, would have no interest in that whatsoever, and doesn't like it. But she made the case here with me for people having the surgery and living happily ever after. That's all I'm saying.
I just don't know that the surgery actually does what it says on the tin, because you don't end up with the opposite sex genitals. That's an impossibility. So, you know, I guess it's the same as women who have ridiculous breast implants or people that have their noses changed.
Yeah.
If that becomes the fixation on which that they believe at the other side of it, they become happy, then I guess they do. It doesn't actually mean that that person has changed sex. It just means that the thing that they focused on has altered.
Yeah. Look, fair enough. Posy Parker is on the show. This is really important stuff, this, the implications of this. We're talking about the High Court decision today that stated very clearly, ruled against Tavistock and Portman NHS Trust and said, look, children need to understand, the families need to understand more about what's going to happen. They need informed consent to undergo treatment with puberty-blocking drugs. One of the things you said about this, and you're absolutely right, nobody has a clue as to what the long-term effects of stopping puberty with drugs are. Nobody has an idea of what it might mean for people in their 20s, in their 30s, in their 40s. And that's very important.
Yeah, of course. I think we've skipped a beat somewhat as a human race when it comes to pretending. Well, I listened to Abigail Shrier and I thought she said something really important on Ben Shapiro. And she was saying, and most of us on this side of the debate have acknowledged this for quite some time, that this drive for early alteration to people's bodies is driven by predominantly autogynephilic men who will never look like women. And they will blame that on male puberty. I mean, it's not even true, because some of the boys that have taken puberty blockers still end up getting a larger and larger skull as they get older, because the human body is a pretty incredible thing. And so all this drive and push to alter the bodies of children is not for those children at all. It's to shield the very most dangerous men who want to live a fantasy and make the rest of us completely go along with it.
My mate Spiro, very good writer and broadcaster, he activistpost.com, Spiro Skouras on YouTube, an enormous YouTube channel with a huge following, has sent me something I thought was a parody, but it isn't. Apparently the actress Ellen Page has come out as transgender and has announced that he is now Elliot Page. Wow. I don't know what to say about that. I fancied Ellen Page.
Was she a lesbian that was sort of quite on board? I think she came out first of all and she was... for lesbian friends of mine, it was cool because she's quite cool. And then she started being a bit sort of on the trans side of stuff. It's no surprise. It's a relevant thing to do, isn't it?
We got into this the first time we spoke. Where is it coming from? I wish I had, you know, access to archives, to newspapers, to academic publications. But I have to believe, without having any evidence, that this is becoming, that this is a fairly, it's not new. You know, we've body dysmorphia, gender dysphoria has been around a long time. But the volume of people now saying that they feel they were born in the wrong body, that's surely shot up, Posy, hasn't it, in recent times?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's a hysteria. So I think there's a number of things. There's the fact that people are not doing tangible things with their lives. So that it's porn. It's a huge amount of transsexual pornography that people are consuming. I think predominantly men, autogynephilic men. I think that there is some sort of permission since Caitlyn Jenner did it, who used to wear his daughter's clothing when they were out. So he's a decent man, isn't he? I think it's all roads really lead to Rome. So you've got the internet, so you've got access, you've got chat rooms, you've got people who don't fit in maybe in normal social settings. So schools are quite difficult, right? And then you go online and you find a group of people, and then the trans activists have hatches, and what they'll do is they'll take someone quite vulnerable and then they'll pull them in to the cult, which sounds really far-fetched and not true, but they talk about it frequently. There are names for these people. They're called egg hatchers. So you've got that. You've got...
egg hatchers. Is there evidence of this online? People can find this stuff.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, I've seen it myself. If I'd been told it, I wouldn't say it, but I've seen people talking about egg hatchers. And so, for example, do you remember the guy David Chaneller, who tortured and raped a little girl in Coventry. And he went away for 22 years quite recently. And he tortured her with a cattle prod whilst he was dressed up as a little girl called Lucy.
Jesus right? Christ, oh my.
And so he's quite an evil, evil man.
Yeah.
And his son was Ashton Chandler, who now goes by the name of Amy and calls himself a woman.
Is that right? Oh, yes, of course. Now it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they had the Green Party head office was the official head office whilst David Chandler was under investigation for this most heinous, despicable, disgusting crime. And apparently in this tiny little house, nobody else knew what was going on when he was torturing a little girl up in the attic in like a two up, two down in Coventry. Now, Amy is known to be a fetishist, nappy wearer, in a polyamorous relationship with two other men.
How do we know this now? Because this Amy, I know this person from coming across her or him or whatever on Twitter.
Right.
And now it all comes back to me with the father and that heinous crime you described there. And I came across this Amy through politics on Twitter. But you're saying stuff now that I don't know to be true. I like to think you're not a lawyer. I've never met you, but you've been on the program before. I've got to say this. I've got to put a caveat on there. Otherwise, I'll be in trouble. How do we know that this is a nappy fetish?
Let me put a caveat on it for you.
Go on.
Judging by Amy's own Twitter and social media presence, and the social media presence and Twitter presence of one of Amy's boyfriend is a person called Something Swales. This is from memory, who talked about fetishizing and fantasizing about raping children. And then those tweets were deleted. They are archived somewhere. People can look them up. I promise I'm not making this up. I have no reason to make things up. There is enough horrible stuff to say that's true.
Yeah, but fair enough, right? So that's fine. But there will be trans folks listening to this now and they will say, I'll tell you what now, Posey, you can take that thing you said about hysteria a minute ago and you can shine that light on yourself. They'll say, maybe you're being hysterical. That's
well,
a one-off.
Let me just get to the point, because this is not
people,
really about one person being trans. This is about what this person has done is shrouded themselves in all different sorts of political activities and then has moved over to America with all the shaky, shoddy connection with, you know, what looks like a danger to children, and now is fundraising in the United States so that he can go into hospitals and read and play games with children. So I think it's, I can't even remember what the question was and why I went.
No, I can't remember either because it's gone off on a tangent, but it's very, it's good this. Look, I know you have these concerns and I do hear from quite a lot of women who have these concerns. And yet when it comes up, and it doesn't come up too often, but I do hear from trans folks who say, Richie, look, you know, now you're going to say that people are hearing what they want to hear or that they're just picking out some aspects of your arguments. But some trans people will say, Richie, what Posey is basically saying is there that, you know, that trans people are predisposed to want to get access to children. We're not, they will say.
Right.
That's what they will say. And they have every right to say that. I know one or two trans people, not very well, but well enough. And they will say to me tomorrow, I can't believe you had her on, Richie. And I can't believe you didn't kick the arse out of her. You didn't give her more stick. But I'm going to do it now. Where's the evidence that if you believe you're born in the wrong body and you want to transition from male to female or vice versa, that you're more likely to be interested in children? There is no evidence.
Right. Let's separate that out. So you have people that might have something called gender dysphoria.
Yeah.
Right. So that will be...
genuine people.
Well... genuinely distressed people. I still don't think they're genuinely trans, but let's call them genuinely distressed, the same as people who want to starve themselves to death, right? With anorexia. So you have those people. Then you have people that are autogynephiles. So these will be men that it used to be called transvestites, and now they call themselves trans women and they want access to spaces. That would be called a paraphilia.
Yeah.
It's very commonplace. If you have one paraphilia, you will have more than one. So these will be a range of different fetishes. That is not saying everybody that has the fetish of dressing up as a woman. And I'm pretty sure that even the most ardent trans rights activist who talks about trans being a very real thing and gender dysphoria being a very real thing, they still understand that there are some people that are actual just fetishists, right? And so what we're talking about really, Rich, is we're talking about the boundary breaking. We're not really saying that everybody who is trans is a pervert who wants to access children. That would be ridiculous. We are saying, though, that when you start eroding the boundaries and safeguarding around children, around women, because of this magic word of trans that then can disguise the fact that somebody is a man, you are putting women and children in unnecessary risk.
Yeah,
that's the thing. It's not saying that everybody who is
that's a who fact.
Wants to
I
wear
agree
a dress
with that.
Wants to attack a woman.
Yeah,
that's just saying that it's more likely that women are more at risk if they're in unisex spaces.
I agree with you. I agree with that. I also agree with some of my friends who say that special places should not be, if a special place is reserved for a woman, like you might think that, I mean, look, I don't agree with positive discrimination full stop anyway, which might piss you off, but anyway, I don't.
No, I don't either.
We agree on that, so I don't agree with it. But if we agreed with it for 5 minutes and we said, right, we can't have 15 guys on that committee, we need to get a couple of ladies in there. Where I also totally agree with you is trans women should not be allowed. I absolutely not. I'm not having it. I'm with you on that. If you want to reserve a space for a woman, it better be a woman. I do not believe that somebody born with a penis and testicles is a woman, no matter what they think. But I feel sorry for them. And sometimes they say, well, we don't want your pity, Rich. I say, okay, but, you know, I'll be happy to stand alongside you for your right to be like that, for your right to live like that. But what I won't tolerate is you telling me to change my language. I won't tolerate you saying that you should be allowed to, you know, use women's changing rooms. I won't tolerate any of that. But then I get posy. A lot of the time I get emails from people going, Richie, I'm trans. Where's this coming from? I don't know any trans women. That's a man who lives as a woman. I don't know any of them who actually want access to female-only spaces. And we don't talk about that enough, Posey. There is some truth in that, that this radical stuff is a real minority of loonies, if I can say that.
Of course you can. Look, some people will find their place in the world, their space in the world, their work in the world easier if they dress in the opposite sex clothing, right? Or get called the opposite sex name, or for all intents and purposes, pretend to be or try and pass as the opposite sex. If that person, for example, the 6'4" courier that came here the other day, I've got stickers on my door and everything, it's a long story, I won't bore you with it. But if that person just wants to do that and say they feel more comfortable, who is anybody, myself included, who's anybody the right to say you can't do that?
Yeah.
You shouldn't do that. You're not allowed to do that. We should stop you doing that. That's not the country in which we live. It's only when the state says that everybody else has to see that person as they see themselves. That's the trick, isn't it? It's not, you know, it's the same as if I want to wear lipstick. You know, some people might not be very happy that I'm a woman wearing lipstick with peroxide blonde hair. They might think that I'm a failure as a woman. And a discredit to this side of the issue. But, you know, it's a free country. Do what you like. Just don't inflict that on anybody else.
Yeah, that's me all over. That's me all over. Listen, as an old trade unionist, as an old lefty, you know, I believe people should live as they would like to live and be left alone. But the really important, again, to use the term caveat, is you cannot tell me I have to change how I live and how I think. I'm not having that. Of course, I'll stand alongside you if you're being denied access to, you know, to work or to a life because of who you are. Of course, I'll stand alongside you. But I'm not going to put up with this, you know, we demand this, we demand that, change language. I'm not having it because it never ends that. I wanted to ask you this. Posy Parker, my listeners give me dogs abuse when I have you in, when I have you on. But you call her by her real name. I did at the beginning of the program. I mentioned your real name at the beginning of the program. It's your pen name. What's this about trans porn? When you mentioned this on the program some time ago, and I left you say it without really challenging you. And afterwards I said, Richie, why didn't you give her a proper chasing over the trans porn thing? And then I started looking into it. And I found that, I hate to admit this now, you were absolutely bang on. I spoke to a couple of people who work for, believe it or not, a couple of very, very, very common and well-known pornography sites. And the incidences in very recent years of heterosexual men accessing trans porn has grown exponentially. Now, I cannot get my head around that.
No, it's I'm so sorry. I've got a rogue phone here. Sorry, Richie.
If you want to take it for a minute there, go on.
I never have a phone in my office. I don't know where that's come from. I think basically what happens is, this is from ClickOff. So there's a campaigner called Jo Bartosz, who's brilliant. And she will say that you click on something, say semi-normal. In fact, there's a brothel in Germany, a super brothel. And so you might go as a... you might go as a normal, well, not normal, because you're not normal if you go to a brothel, in my view. So you might go to a brothel, or you might go and look at porn, and then the next video is something a bit further along, because what the pornographers have to do is they have to keep you coming back, and the brothel owners have to keep you coming back. So the next time it will be like a level higher, and then a level higher, and then a level higher, and eventually you're into really dodgy.
You're talking about dopamine. Now, this is really important. You will know a woman called Gail Dines, won't you?
I do, yes.
Good friend of mine, has been on with me over the years, 10, 12 years I've been interviewing Gail, although not recently. I must get her back on. Well, brilliant work on how you, if you're addicted to porn, particularly porn, I mean, porn is not like when we got videos years ago when we were kids and we snuck videos and it was cheesy music and it was
no,
a man.
It really isn't.
No,
is
it's not. It was a man and woman and they were making natural love on these videos.
With natural bodies.
With natural bodies, that's right. These Italian movies that we used to get when we were teenagers. And total innocent idiots we were. Obviously, pornography on Pornhub and XXX and all that is totally different. And she educated me, that woman, about what that does to the brains of people, not just young men, but anybody who watches it. It messes around with dopamine levels, doesn't it? So after a while, watching two people have nice, intimate sex is not good enough. And like you just described there, you start moving on and on and on. It becomes more graphic, more gratuitous. It often becomes violent, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, and then you implant this fantasy. And what we know from criminals, really, and people that go on to commit the most heinous crime is, you know, mass murderers, people that murder women, it's often just an extension of a flashing, and then they go from flashing, and then the ultimate in sort of sexual gratification is the murder of a woman, and it becomes removed from sex because that's gone long ago. And I think that's the same with sort of certain sorts of porn. That's why some AGPs can still have their penises inverted, because actually the act of sex is so far gone. I say this as someone who watched Channel 4 when it was first out, and there was a program on S&M, and a man's ultimate happiness was to be, I won't be too graphic, slammed in a dirty toilet seat.
Yeah.
Like a part of him. Now, that wasn't... that was his sexual gratification, because his brain had just taken these things slowly and taken it to a place where actually there was no one else involved. There was no intimacy. There was no sort of visual pleasure or receptors. And that was where it was. And I think the pornography, pornification of our society is very, very, very dangerous.
The access is ridiculously easy for youngsters. It is. Mm. And when this came up most recently, I think the last time this came up was about 16, 18 months ago. I remember the programme. And I had some listeners who said, you're talking nonsense, Richie. Again, to use that word, hysterical. You're being a bit hysterical. Because I was saying that if you go to the homepage of some of the, again, more well-known sites, the offerings immediately are violent pornography. Mm. They are...
or incest.
Yeah, dreadful stuff, yeah. Yeah, I mean...
lots of incest. Yeah. It's so bizarre.
Yeah, straight up. That's what you get. And nobody could ever accuse me of being a virtue signaler. I'm not. It sickens me, that. And I have to wonder, what does it do to any child who might be able to come across this and look at it unimpeded? Because of the access to devices and everything else, what does it say to a young boy or a young girl to see that level of brutality and stuff? It's horrendous. And again, if their kids listen, don't let them listen to this. But if you're an adult and you're not new to this, just go to the homepage of some of these sites. Look at the stuff. It's brutally horrible, violent, rape fetish stuff. It's dreadful. Why? Where did that come from? Does anybody know where that came from, you know?
What amazes me is you'll have, so there was a young woman who'd been on there and she'd been filmed being raped when she was about 15. And she couldn't get those videos taken down very quickly at all. It was a big fight. And as soon as you'd taken it down from one site, there was somewhere else and then springing back up. And you know what? It's not even, there's not even a criminal act. Now, if I did something to you like that, Richie, if you and your partner fell out, and she wanted to take revenge, and she put that online, that's a crime.
Yeah.
If she put it on Pornhub and they put it out repeatedly to humiliate you, or if you were a child, if you're 15, it's not even a crime. There is no one responsible at those companies when they do things like that. There's no financial penalty, nothing.
A couple of Irish rugby players got into trouble a couple of years ago, and I couldn't understand this thing where they sexually assaulted a woman in a room, and there was two of them or three of them. And again, I'm not necessarily a Christian. I'm agnostic. I don't know anything. I'm not somebody who is remotely conservative. But I don't understand. I mean, blokes wanting to be, I don't know, two or three blokes together in a room with a woman. I just don't get that. There is nothing more horrific to me than that. Again, not because I'm some, you know, shy and reserved, withdrawn Catholic kid from Ireland. I'm not, but for me, sex is about intimacy with the person you love, intimacy, privacy. I just don't get that. And yet it seems to be, you know, hugely popular amongst people. My mate Spiro, by the way, I've got to mention this, this is important. On this thing, and Dr. Vernon Coleman said something very similar to me, toxins in our environments might be having an impact on masculinity. And other aspects of who we are, endocrine disruptors. Vernon talked about estrogen in our water. Does any of that, you know, compute for you? Does it mean anything to you? Do you think there's any truth in that?
I think it's, I don't know. I don't know whether estrogen in the water would make men more likely to watch violent porn. I don't think so.
No.
I tell you what I think. I think people have lost their way. I think there's a lack of cohesion. I think we don't live in communities. I'm not religious. I'm an atheist. I've never believed in God. But I do think that the lack of organized religion and common purpose because of organized religion, all small communities, or farming, or doing tangible things, planting something in the garden, watching it grow, waiting, delayed gratification. All those things, I think, are just chipping away at the human condition. Oh, and I think without purpose, we look far too much inside ourselves and for instant gratification. The Chinese, for example, and they're no bastion of humanity, but they sort of, they have a much older culture and they talk about happiness being, you know, something that's quite fleeting. And I think we have begun over here just looking for happiness, and happiness, I don't think, gives you actual contentment. It doesn't make you a good person. It just makes you happy for 5 minutes and it doesn't last.
That's an interesting theory. I wouldn't dismiss that at all. What about those who say, particularly with the, some of the things we're seeing now, with some of the ways that we would be emerging from this pandemic, that there are those who are pushing a transhumanist agenda?
Oh, I totally buy that.
Yeah.
100%. I've heard people talk about it on the radio as if it's completely normal to want to live forever. I can't think of anything worse.
No.
You know, I've got four children, so my life has value and purpose in the fact that hopefully I'm raising four really decent human beings. I've met people who think that the whole Syrian war was about human trafficking and taking organs. I'm not going to dismiss those people. I've watched their research. It's pretty good stuff.
Look at the abuse that goes on. Look at the abuse that goes on through NGOs like charities when they go to places like Haiti. I mean, we know this to be true. You know, I can say this on air because I am a respected and respectable journalist. I have never put out information on my radio program ever knowingly that was untrue. But I know that the Clinton Foundation, for example, and some of the people involved with that have been involved in disaster zones in trafficking children. And I'm no QAnon lunatic now. I don't buy any of that nonsense or any of that. But that's a common thing, that, yeah. No doubt. Yeah.
Well, I think when you get to, I always say to my kids that, you know, if when the lottery's up, I always sort of say, I wouldn't like to win it all. I'd like to win enough to change our lives, but not so much that we would have no purpose to every day.
Yeah.
And I think once you get to a certain level of power, what's next? You know, if the dopamine, we know that dopamine, as you just said, sort of in pornography and in lots of bits where the kids play too much online gaming, you know, what happens when you've got everything?
Yeah.
Like, where do you go for your next?
The last taboo, something? Isn't it? It's the last taboo. I want to ask you this before we run out of time. Back to where we came in. We were talking earlier on about the High Court decision that clinics, well, it's the only clinic in the country, the Tavistock and Portman NHS Trust, the puberty blocking drugs, the High Court judges said, look, you can't give informed consent to teenagers. That's good. It's an important thing. I agree with that. Will this debate lose its toxicity anytime soon, do you think? It seems to be this one area of discussion where it just, I've never known anything as toxic. And of course, that ultimately leads to, you know, no real discussion or no real debate. Any chance anytime soon that we'll be able to have a proper conversation about these things without some of the things that happen to you happening? You know, that level of targeting, what do you think?
I don't think so, because it's been framed so poorly, and the people, you know, we talk about trans rights as if people who call themselves trans don't have the same rights as every single one of us. Of course they do. And we're asking women to give up their rights and their spaces. So it can't be anything but a very hot topic. You can't take the heat out of that, saying to women, by the way, you're going to have to give up some of your spaces for men, or we're going to change the bodies of kids. You know, if that isn't heated and, you know, toxic's a new word for this sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
But if it isn't a heated debate, then people aren't listening. I mean, I personally don't think enough people are listening. Maybe this Keira Bell will do something. But like I said right at the beginning, in my mind, I would like to see all private providers being kept to this judgment also. I'd like Dr. Helen Weberly, who had to go to Spain. She was fined £12,000, lived in Wales, because she was prescribing online, I think. You can look that up to double check. She's called Gender GP on Twitter. She's already today, after the announcement, saying that they will assess 13-year-olds and prescribe puberty blockers.
Jesus.
So I would like to see the likes of all providers. I would like it to be illegal for parents and or children to access puberty blockers online and through the post also.
Come back anytime you want. It's good to have you on, Posey. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Lovely to talk to you.
You too. And Merry Christmas, by the way, to you and
yes,
yours.
Yes, and you.
Thanks, Posey. Posey Parker there, as you know, a campaigner on these issues, a feminist campaigner, and took an enormous amount of flack in recent years for that. That decision today, High Court saying, look, the clinic in this country is not likely to be able to give informed consent to undergo treatment with puberty blocking drugs. You would hope that parents will see that and maybe, you know, look at their 13 or 14 year old children who might be going through it and say to them, wait. Look at Keira Bell as a cautionary tale. Wait, because you might feel differently in 4 or 5 or 6 years' time. You might feel differently in 12 months' time. So don't do that. Don't take those puberty blocking drugs, because you have no idea what sort of liberties you're taking with your own health, you know, looking ahead, because they have no idea. Nobody has any idea what subjecting children to these puberty blocking drugs is going to mean for them in terms of their health in the future. It's an important story. That right, that's it for me for Tuesday's programme. That flew by. I want to say thanks again to Emma for coming on the programme earlier on. Not her real name. I mentioned Emma. Professional lady, came on to talk about how to respond if your company asks you or tries to compel you to have a COVID vaccine. That was very important. I will copy and paste what Emma sent to me and I will put it on our Facebook page. And again, big thanks and a big shout out to Posey Parker sharing her time with us this afternoon. That's it. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. Look after yourselves and one another. I'm going to leave you with this from Coldplay. And Yes. It is Coldplay, yeah. Okay, see you tomorrow. Bye.